Please be seated. Good morning. I'll do a quick check through to see if there's anything arising over the weekend. I understand Ms. Ford, you're here. Who are you here for? I've forgotten. Sorry.
Your Honour, and Commissioners here for Horticulture New Zealand.
Hort New Zealand.
Yes.
Okay. And you're cross-examining this morning?
No, Your Honour. We're here as a presence for Hort, with Mr. McIndoe being a joint witness for us as well.
Okay. No, that's fine. Very good. Understand that Mr. McIndoe hasn't arrived because of restrictions at the airport. That's correct?
Yes.
So we're proposing to take his evidence by way of ADL, but won't do so until after lunch, when we can ensure that we've checked the connection with Mr. McIndoe and that he is able to beam into us at that point. That means we're going to be rising at 12 o'clock. I've been told to rise at 12 o'clock for those arrangements to be made. And is 1 o'clock okay for a restart, or do you need slightly longer?
No, 1 o'clock should be fine.
1 o'clock should be fine. Any difficulties with that? Okay, thank you. Now, lots of evidence came through over the weekend, and Ms. Williams saw the evidence from your witness. Your witness is, I think, attached either to his evidence or it's the last page of his evidence, some further changes?
Yes.
Now, I don't know whether they're changes to his original evidence. I mean, I've read his evidence, but I don't recollect whether they're changes to his original evidence or just changes, in fact, to Mr. De Plaisemaker's evidence, which otherwise he accepts. I guess the point being, it's actually very important that any track changes be to the entire document. Otherwise, we're going to lose the thread, and I just don't want to reread.
Thank you, Your Honour. Look, as Mr. Brass says, I think, in his evidence, that was actually prepared whilst he was away at the Marlborough mediation, so he didn't have access to the full suite of things. What perhaps I could ask him to do, Your Honour, is to prepare, because I believe it was to the 14 March version. So if I ask Mr. Brass to bring that along and attach that as an appendix when he gives his evidence, would that assist the court? A full version of the plan changes.
This time, can he do it in portrait, not in landscape? That would be quite helpful.
Yes.
And so, okay, so keep in mind that those changes are changes to changes he recommends to Mr. De Plaisemaker's 14th March version, and if he could bring them along, that would be excellent. Thank you.
Yes,
that was the only thing arising.
Arrange for that.
Okay. Mr. Page, your witness, Ms. Dicey, so she's also produced a brief of evidence, and she's produced an attachment. The attachment refers to the schedule, but there's no text for the schedule. My guess is, or I might be wrong, does she want to bring across from her original brief of evidence, and I guess across from the original submission, changes to the schedule? Because if she does, they need to be in this plan change, not in some other plan change, unless it's her evidence that they ought to be in some other plan change, some other plan, rather. So what's the story there? Because I've only got a page about a schedule. I haven't got any of the other changes that I know that she was recommending.
Well, my recollection is that the controlled activity pathway that Ms. Dicey's evidence addresses doesn't deal with the schedule, because the schedule is only relevant insofar as the controlled activity process deals with the sinking lid on paper allocation.
Okay, so if there's no controlled activity rule, there is no schedule.
Correct.
So why would she be amending the subtitle to the schedule, unless there's some other stuff in the schedule that is relevant? And that's where I've got confused, because I can see that the title page to the schedule is there, and she amends it as a minor amendment.
Yes. I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head, ma'am. I can take instructions about that and report. But I do know from the evidence that she's effectively said, well, if there's going to be a controlled activity pathway, let it be Mr. Ensor's version of it. And so then the question of interrogating the take data to identify take use doesn't arise.
Sorry. Okay. So I understand that the changes which are now proposed by Ms. Dicey are changes to this PC7.
Yes.
And a major new policy which would result in a fully discretionary activity rule.
Yes.
That being the case, I think what you've just told me is if there's no controlled activity rule, there is no need for a schedule.
In relation to the controlled activity rule, that's correct, but the discretionary activity rule that Ms. Dicey has drafted does refer to the schedule, so it continues to be relevant because under the discretionary activity rule, it's anticipated that paper allocation, unused allocation, yeah, would be removed.
Okay, so there is a schedule then.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Where is it? That was the only point of the question, is that it should be there.
Yes. The thinking was that the schedule would be resolved through the caucusing process.
Mm.
And so we didn't see value in Ms. Dicey offering evidence about what the schedule might contain at this point.
I don't disagree with you about that. But I guess the important thing for the court is that it have contained, you know, complete set of provisions now tracking through with the different versions of the evidence.
Yes.
So in the same way, you know, as I said to Ms. Williams, actually your witness has to reproduce the version of the document together with his further recommendations that he supports. It's not for the court to be constantly working backwards and forwards across the evidence to go, where are we at with this? So even though I understand that it is a matter for expert conferencing, the content of the schedule itself, it's important for us that we're all on the same page as of Tuesday morning.
Yes.
Understanding the page may or may not be rewritten,
yes,
as a consequence of expert conferencing. So the direction for both the Director General and your client will be to file by tomorrow morning, 9 a.m, a complete set of provisions which represent the witness's recommendations as of at least today. Understood?
Yes. Yep. Well, that should be fairly straightforward.
It should be really straightforward. Yeah. Thank you. All right. On things that need to be done, I think we are awaiting from ORC an update to the Common Bundle to bring in to the Common Bundle, I think, changes to the operative plan which might pertain to Plan Change 6 or Plan Change 6AA or something.
Yes.
Those changes aren't in our documents and need to be. So I suspect it's not many pages at all, but and probably the most convenient thing is to direct by 9 a.m. tomorrow morning that we have copies of those pages with, you know, everybody's agreement, so we can just replace the text that we've got in our Common Bundle.
We do have hard copies of those available, so we'll provide those to the registrar during the course of the day and provide an updated electronic bundle which has those replacement pages in it.
Mm. Good.
And there was another matter outstanding in relation to the question you asked for Mr. De Pelsmaker to clarify which submitters had raised the issue of priorities.
Yes.
Now, that analysis has been completed.
Mm.
We're in the court's hands as to how you'd like that information put forward, either through a further supplementary brief of evidence containing the analysis, or I could attach it to a memorandum of counsel, but it's more in the nature of an assessment from a planner, which tends towards a supplementary statement.
Yeah. You can put it through a supplementary statement, and then if no party takes any objection to the same or wishes to examine on the same, it may be able to be taken by consent. I think from our point of view, knowing who has made the submission, then knowing who is legally represented and who the court might call upon to ask questions or direct, make submissions is really important. Now, over Monday, I was meant to have issued directions just confirming the matters that we're talking about and confirming a couple of other matters in terms of providing people the opportunity to cross-examine where we've yet to do so. I think Trustpower on the Trustpower case, Fish and Game. Trustpower's further evidence, Fish and Game's further evidence, and there's one other party, plus anybody else who's going to be calling further evidence in response to Regional Council. And I apologise for that. Didn't get to it yesterday. It was waylaid by other matters. Yeah. But we'll get to it.
Very good.
All right. So if you could give those updated papers to Ms. Harlow, and she can update our folders. And when do you think you'll... brief will be in?
Tomorrow morning.
Morning, yeah, 9 o'clock, that's fine, and then we'll circulate it and ask if anyone wishes to ask any questions about that. All right, that was it from me overnight. Anything from anyone else? No. All right, so I think we're going to be turning to you, Mr. Page, for your submissions.
Yes, may it please the Court. So I have provided Madam Registrar with four hard copies of my opening, and I've also given the Court hard copies of four of the cases that I mentioned in my submissions. I haven't provided a hard copy of all of them at this, but can do. My impression is that the Court has more than enough paperwork, and that if I'm not actually going to take you to the decision, then the utility of having a hard copy to hand immediately is perhaps diminished. But we can deal with that as we come. So if I may start at my first paragraph then. Otago Water Resources Users Group is an unincorporated body of water permit holders in Otago. Its members extend from the Upper Clutha through the Alexandra Basin and include the Cardrona, Arrow, Bannockburn, Pisa area, Teviot, Manuherikia and Tyree catchments. ORUG's members include all of the irrigation companies in the Manuherikia catchment. The four Manuherikia Valley irrigation companies are also the owners of the Falls Dam Company. It has been said many times by the Minister that deemed permit holders have had 30 years to prepare themselves for the expiry of their permits in October 2021. The Court may be invited to infer that the permit holders are unprepared for the change that awaits them. ORUG is here to tell the Court that its members have spent much of the last decade preparing for this day and they are ready to go. It is disappointing that having got to this point that they are ready to commit to replacing their deemed permits with RMA permits, that the Otago Regional Council may be heard to say that it isn't ready. It too has had 30 years to prepare for this process. These submissions do not traverse ground already covered by Council for the other parties where there is little disagreement. These submissions focus on the key matters for ORUG and respond to some matters raised in submissions by other Council. Section 67.3 of the Act requires that a change to the Regional Plan Water must give effect to the NPSFM 2020. ORUG accepts that for PC7 that obligation extends only insofar as it is within the scope of the plan change to do so. That being said, ORUG's position is that Plan Change 7 has the effect of delaying the implementation of the NPSFM 2020 in several critical respects, and that is contrary to the express requirement of Section 67.3 of the Act. It is submitted that the Court does not have the jurisdiction to confirm Plan Change 7 if it accepts that Plan Change 7 has the effect of delaying or putting off something that should be done to give effect to the NPSFM 2020 during the six-year-plus period that PC7 intends to operate. The Environment Court's description of the NPSFM 2020 in Minister of Conservation and others in Northern Regional Council from earlier this year is adopted. At paragraphs 23 to 32, the Environment Court tracks the way in which the NPSFM 2020 picks up and advances the concept of Te Mana O Te Wai from the NPSFM 2014. The Environment Court recognised the primacy given to the health and well-being of water bodies and freshwater ecosystems in the NPSFM 2020. The Court observed, and ORUG adopts, the finding that We consider that the Regional Council cannot derogate from the mandatory requirements of superior documents and the primacy of the health and well-being of water bodies and freshwater ecosystems. ORUG recognises that other parties consider that the operative regional plan water has deficiencies. ORUG does not agree with much of the criticism, but what matters is whether the solution to the perceived problems derogate from Te Mana o Te Wai in a way that is impermissible under Section 67(3) of the Act. The case for the ORC is that a temporary holding pattern is necessary to enable a replacement land and water regional plan to give effect to the NPSFM 2020, and thereafter the resource consent decisions to be made under that plan. That is a superficially attractive proposition, but what is overlooked is what may be lost in the meantime. It is submitted that the Regional Council's case fails to give an adequate attention to, firstly, clause 4.11 of the NPS. Every local authority must give effect to the NPSFM 2020 as soon as reasonably practicable. Plan making is but one function under the NPSFM 2020. Deciding resource consents is another function. Under section 104(1)(b) of the Act, where a resource consent authority has to have regard to the NPSFM 2020. The have regard to requirement is described by Mr. De Pelsmaker as insufficient because it is non-directive. That proposition appears to ignore that the fact that have regard to is the same formula that will apply in relation to the land and water regional plan whenever that might be available. It is submitted that the alleged deficiency is overcome by the position with respect to the relative weight to be given to the statutory documents on their, based on their relative ages. This is a position that is already being advanced by the ORC with respect to resource consents being now decided in the light of the NPSFM 2020 and Plan Change 7. Thirdly, the Act specifically provides for review powers to impose limits on resource use under Section 128(1)(b), and for that to be done in an integrated way pursuant to Section 128(2)(a). Parliament has made specific provision for that method to be deployed to address the need to comply with resource use limits. It is not for the ORC to say that it is too expensive or contentious to be bothered with. Fourthly, that despite the complaints made by some parties, a number of resource consents have been granted that have had direct regard to the NPSFM 2014 and found that long-term consents in the circumstances of those cases give effect to the NPSFM in the specific factual context in those cases. The most prominent of those, of course, being the Environment Court's decision to replace the deemed permits in the Lindis catchment. And next, for so long as the deemed permits are not replaced by RMA permits that impose minimum flows and residual flows in the various catchments, there remains a risk to Indigenous biodiversity in the waterways that will not be effectively managed. Ngāi Tahu may say that it accepts that risk, and Mr. Ellison was explicit about that when asked questions by the court, but the court is required to apply Section 6C of the Act and Tier 1 of Te Mana o Te Wai dispassionately, putting the needs of Indigenous fauna first, despite, with respect, Ngāi Tahu's views. And lastly, the rollover process promoted by the Council also risks missing opportunities for steps to be taken to phase out over-allocation in contravention of the obligation to begin implementing the NPS as soon as reasonably practicable. All the policy making in the world will not save the non-migratory galaxids of Otago if the permits held to take water are not designed to protect them. It is the Otago Regional Council's position, or so it seems, that doing nothing to that end in Otago for at least 6 years is an acceptable outcome. ORUG does not agree with that proposition because they say that we can and must do better. ORUG's position is succinctly summarised in the evidence of Mr. Hickey at his paragraphs 61 to 83. And Mr Hickey says the following at paragraph 74, and I won't read that to the court.
If we could reread it, thank you.
Yes, well, then, what is the content of the obligation to give effect to the NPSFM 2020? The obligation to recognise the primacy of Te Mana o Te Wai and to give effect to it is a substantive obligation in relation to all decisions affecting fresh water. And my submission is including this plan change. The importance of this is to understand that the court must be satisfied that resource consents granted pursuant to Plan Change 7 will themselves give effect to NPSFM 2020 in the short term, just as the plan change is intended to enable the NPSFM 2020 to be achieved in the long term. This is where ORUG departs from the Regional Council. ORUG's case is that the first obligation in giving effect to the NPSFM 2020 is to allocate flows to the needs of the river under the first priority of Te Mana o Te Wai. That is achieved at least in part by establishing minimum and residual flows that apply to each take of water. ORUG is perfectly aware that giving effect to the NPSFM 2020 for each application in each waterway is a painstaking, complex and expensive process. It is ill-suited to short-term permits. The best solution is to address the NPSFM 2020 in the context of full information where all matters can be addressed comprehensively. The consequence of ORUG's position is that there is no simple and easy consenting pathway to deal with the short term between now and the notification of the Land and Water Regional Plan in December 2023. It may well be that Professor Skelton was alive to that difficulty when he recommended that the Minister legislate a legislative change to deal with the term of deemed permits rather than heap upon an overstretched Regional Council yet another resource consent process when it is least capable of dealing with it. Much of Part 3 of the NPSFM anticipates a methodical building process. Firstly, identification of Te Mana o Te Wai. Secondly, building long-term visions for FMUs. Identifying the values for FMUs, setting environmental outcomes. Identifying attribute baselines, setting attribute targets, and setting limits, rules, and action plans to achieve environmental outcomes. All of that seems a logical sequence, but it is not a complete understanding of the NPS's requirements. Some things are urgent and do not wait for the NOF process to be followed. It is submitted that the NPSFM 2020 requires the ORC to move swiftly to address some considerations as soon as reasonably practicable. Firstly, under Clause 3.11, Part 3 processes are non-exhaustive and do not limit the general obligation to give effect to the objectives and policies of the NPS. That means giving effect to is not subservient to the NOF process. The obligation exists now and applies to resource consent decisions.
I just pause here a second. I want to have that provision in front of me. Otherwise, I won't be following what you're saying, and I'd like to follow what you're saying.
Thank you.
And I do wish to track through also where you're making submissions in relation to specific provisions so that I can understand it when you're saying.
Yes. And so in the next half dozen paragraphs, I addressed specific provisions of the NPS, so we'll move to them one by one.
Mm.
So that in my paragraph 21B, the next clause I refer to is 317.3A. And you will find that on Common Bundle, page 685. My submission is that all resource consents for taking water must identify flows and levels at which taking is no longer allowed. That obligation exists now. This is, of course, exactly what ORUG's members have been doing, but exactly what Plan Change 7 does not do. This calls into question the fundamental premise of the PC7 hold the line, do nothing proposition.
Can you just assist me in identifying where in the NPS, or maybe it's another instrument, planning instrument, that the obligation exists now is directed?
Well, if I can take you to the land clause 317.3. What you will see is that the obligation is to identify flows and levels in which, under paragraph, subparagraph A, taking is no longer allowed.
Okay, just let me reread that.
And so, what I want the court to observe is the difference in the language between that clause 3 and the language in clause 317.1, which speaks specifically of environmental flows. And environmental flows are things which are set under clause 3.16.
Just pause here a second. So what's the language shift or difference in language?
Well, if we look at maybe the easiest thing to do is to start with clause 3.16 and observe the process for setting environmental flows and levels for each FMU. And what we can see from 3.16 subsection 2, they must achieve environmental outcomes for the values relating to the FMU and all the relevant long-term visions. So the setting of environmental levels is part of that NOF process, which builds on the visions for each FMU and is intended to implement or achieve environmental outcomes, which again is part of that NOF setting process. So we know that that hasn't occurred yet, that process, and we know that it can't occur yet. So, but when we look at, go down to clause 3.17, subsection 1 picks up the same language as clause 3.16, in order to meet environmental flows and levels. Every regional council, and it sets out four matters that are obligatory. So it's apparent that clause 317.1 builds on 3.16. But when you look at subclause 3, it doesn't use the environmental flows terminology from clause 3.16 and 317.1. It stands alone in my submission. It simply says, where a regional council Sorry, where a regional plan or any resource consent allows the taking, damming, diversion or discharge of water, the plan or resource consent must identify the flows and levels which allow the taking, damming or diversion will be restricted and no longer allowed, or a discharge will be required. The discharge, in my submission, relates to damming consents. So what my proposition is that if you compare the language of Clause 317.3 with 317.1, Clause 317.3 has an interim effect to require the setting of flows and levels at which taking must stop, despite the fact that environmental flows and levels haven't been yet set under Clause 316.
Just pause for a second, I'm making a note of that.
D.
Yes.
Refers to imposing conditions on resource consents.
Yes.
Would you suggest that might also be part of an interim possibility in addition to your three, or would you not read it that way in relation to these provisions?
Well, no, Commissioner. You see, my submission is that Clause 317.1 deals with the situation where environmental flows and levels have been set under Clause 316, whereas Clause 317.3 is not contingent upon environmental flows and limits having been set under Clause 316. And so it's effectively an interim position that consents that are granted to take water, pending flows and limits being set under Clause 316, are nevertheless required to have flows and levels identified at which taking must stop.
With that in mind, I wish to read 317 again.
So your point is that in reading D, you need to read from the top and take a lot of notice of the ends. Is that your point?
Well, Clause 317.1 starts with the words, in order to meet environmental flows and levels, and then A to D follow from that proposition. Clause 317.3 does not begin with that proposition. It simply requires a resource consent that allows taking, amongst other things, to identify flows and levels at which taking must stop.
Carry on. I don't want you to carry on to subparagraph C. I want you to finish and then we'll think about what you're saying in the context of what's actually written.
Yeah.
Sorry, I shouldn't have interrupted.
No. So the relevance of all of this is that if it is the case that 317.3 applies to consents granted under Plan Change 7, then it is inconsistent with the idea that a simple rollover process is available to the court and therefore permissible under Section 67.3.
So your submission stands or falls, if you like, on interpreting flows and levels as being something other than environmental flows and levels dealt with in paragraph, or clause rather, 317.1.
And 316.
And 316. So flows and levels are not environmental flows and levels in paragraphs, in clauses 316 and 317.1, correct?
That's correct. Because of the difference in the language and the fact that clause 317 starts with the words in order to meet environmental flows and levels, and clause 317.3 does not.
So is it your case that in every case now, the Regional Council obligation under this NPS, and in particular 317 sub, 3, so that's for the record, clause 3.17 subparagraph 3, the obligation now is on the Council to be imposing flows and levels. Correct?
Yes.
What are flows and levels? What is that nature of the obligation?
Well, ORUG's view is that flows and levels are referable to minimum flows and residual flows, which control the limits under which water can be taken.
Is it also ORUG's view that flows and levels incorporates or includes the allocation blocks in the allocation blocks or allocation limits as may be provided in Schedule 2A of the Water Plan, or as may be provided by any rule, any policy or rule of the Water Plan?
No, my submission is flows and levels are referable to the state of the water body that the resource consent relates to, rather than allocation blocks.
Is it ORUG's view or your submission that minimum flows can be imposed without also the imposition of allocation blocks or limits as may be provided for under Schedule 2A or the Water Plan?
Yes, clause 317.3 does not require allocation limits to be imposed to comply with it. It relates to limits to be that are set on a resource consent.
So so that I can ensure that I have heard you correctly, it is ORUG's view that minimum flows, and I think to be fair you said residual flows, may be imposed under clause 3.17.3, but not allocation blocks or limits as may be provided for by the water plan, either under Schedule 2A or, any other policy or rule, correct?
My submission is limited to what Section 317.3 is requiring. Mm-hmm. And my submission is that it is requiring flows or levels in relation to the water body from which water is taken to be set. It is not requiring allocation blocks to be set for each water body as part of that exercise. Allocation blocks may be, under other provisions, required, but are not required by this clause of the NPS.
Is it ORUG's case that allocation blocks or limits, as may be provided for by the water plan, are required as a policy or rule in Plan Change 7?
No, allocation blocks are required under the operative plan, but not under Plan Change 7.
So is it ORUG's case that all that is required under Plan Change 7 is the imposition of minimum flows or residual flows? And I think from Ms. Dicey's evidence, secession conditions as well.
Yes. Well, you see, Ms. Dicey's evidence promotes a discretionary pathway in which there's a whole lot of complex matters that would need to be addressed.
Understood, but I'm trying to tease out what your submission is or what your client's instructions are.
Well, my submission is that the NPS, through Clause 317.3, requires flows and levels to be set on resource consents. that identify a point at which taking is no longer allowed. Now, that's, in my submission, not a reference to allocation blocks, because allocation blocks, in ORUG's view, is about the distribution of water between interests rather than dealing with the circumstances of the water body itself.
OK. So is it? Do I understand correctly that in your submission, or in ORUG's view, that allocation blocks or limits are not correlated with minimum flows, residual flows, or secession conditions? for addressing any effect in the environment, that they're only, firstly, what's your view on that?
My submission is that allocation blocks are there to ensure that... Well, the purpose of them is to identify the amount of water that can be taken from a water body, but they function to serve Tier 2 and Tier 3 functions under the hierarchy in Te Mana o Te Wai. My submission is that the levels and flows referred to in Clause 317.3 are there to serve a Tier 1 function. So although allocation blocks are set at the time that minimum flows for catchments are set, they are there to serve different purposes. So Your Honour is correct that they are correlated, because the level at which a minimum flow is set affects the reliability of the water that can be taken and therefore the efficiency with which it can be used, which goes on to influence what the allocation block might be. So in answer to your question, are they correlated? Yes, they are. Do they serve the same purpose? My submission, no, they don't.
Paragraph C.
I now come to Clause 312. In 312.1c, in order to achieve target attribute states, a regional council may impose conditions on resource consents that include the power to impose Section 128 review conditions to bring activities into compliance with target attribute states. And so it anticipates that consents might be granted now and modified later to achieve target attribute states.
just wish to read this provision. So it's the purpose of paragraph 21C and your submission on clause 3.12.1.C of the MPS simply that this is the imposition of a condition to achieve a target attribute state may take place prior to the identification of those attribute states in accordance with the process set out by the MPS.
It seems to me, or my submission is that there are two possibilities. Either once a target attribute state has been set, a condition may directly control the exercise of a permit to achieve the target attribute state, or a condition may be imposed enabling the consent to be reviewed once a target attribute state has been set, to then enable that attribute state to be achieved.
Okay, just pause there a second, I'm making a note.
There's a similar provision in 1, 2 and 3 relating to different attribution, different appendices. You've selected 1C rather than 2C or 3C.
Well, yes, I've seized on C as the example, but it would apply equally to the other.
It does apply equally.
Yes.
I just wondered why you'd only identified one, but that's your example.
Yes.
But there are other examples.
Yes.
That your argument
because
would equally apply to.
Yes, that's correct, Commissioner.
Thank you. Just wanted to be clear.
Yep. D.
Coming now to D, and I draw attention to clause 319, requiring the Regional Council to assess trends and attribute states. And if a deteriorating trend is more likely than not, and the court will remember the evidence from Naitahu earlier in the hearing that in their view that's likely to be the case, then clause 320 applies.
Okay, I just want to read that for myself. And you will address whether or not 320, clause 320 of the MPS can apply now ahead of the general processes described in the MPS for in relation to the attribute states or independent of the processes described in the MPS for attribute states?
Well, that's determined by the definitions of degraded and degrading. And so I accept that in both cases they refer to target attribute states.
Yeah, and what do we know about target attribute states and the work completed by the Regional Council under this MPS?
Well, at the present time, the Council hasn't set target attribute states. But it is measuring water quality by reference to the attribute states in Appendix 2A, and that was the effect of Dr. Snelder's evidence. So the submission is that if the council is detecting through its monitoring network that attributes are deteriorating, then it is not sufficient simply to do nothing for 6 years. The council ought to be putting in place measures to halt that degrading trend.
Is it your submission that clause 320 of the MPS applies now ahead of the Regional Council setting target attribute states?
Well, I can't go as far as to say that that's a mandatory obligation, because the clause 321 refers to must. But ORUG's view is that clause 4.1 of the NPS requires implementation of the NPS as soon as reasonably practicable. And so the submission is that it's contrary to the concept of tamana otawai to observe a degradation or a degraded water body and then decide to do nothing about it when there are reasonably practicable options to halt or reverse that trend.
Just so I've underchecked my understanding of your submission in relation to clause 320. Again, are you saying this? I understood you to say, and you correct me if I'm wrong, that 320 is not a mandatory obligation where the regional council has not set target attribute states, but that there is. A obligation under clause 4.11 to give effect to the national policy statement as soon as reasonably practicable, and that includes halting the degradation or degrading trend in a water body. So it's a general submission as to what is required. Now, in relation to tamana otawai. Have I understood that correctly?
Yes, where there are reasonably practicable options available to the regional council to do that.
Okay. How does your client define degraded or degrading?
Well, I don't have a definition for you, but for example, if a waterway is being run dry on account of a take of water, where that is not a natural characteristic of the water body, then it's hard to imagine on any basis that isn't a degraded water body.
Well, that is one example. Does your client define degraded or degrading in relation to Appendix 2A of the NPS? And in particular, the attributes required limits on resource use, both in terms of the band attribute, attribute band and description, and numeric attribute state.
Well, where a water body is below any national bottom line, in Appendix 2A, my submission that is by its nature degraded, because my understanding is that it isn't permissible to set a target attribute state that's below the national bottom line.
And where the water body is above the national bottom line, is it degraded or degrading? And are you calling evidence on that point?
No, I'm not.
No. And what is your submission on that point, where the water body is above a national bottom line? May that water body also be degrading or degraded relative to the attribute band and numeric attribute state?
Well, the answer to that is perhaps not as helpful as it might be, because all I can say about that is it might be, but it depends on each particular water body.
Is it your evidence? Oh, no, it's not your evidence, sorry. Is it your submission that for the purpose of ascertaining whether something is degraded or degrading, the attribute bands and numeric attribute states, as set out in Appendix 2A, are relevant?
Yes.
In any resource consent application?
Yes.
Is it also your submission that the that the consent authority would not need to reach for the commonly accepted meaning of those terms when considering what is proposed by ORUG in its relief, but instead is to reach for the NPS, and in particular Appendix 2A?
Well, where a target attribute state hasn't been set, in my submission, it's competent for the Regional Council in analysing water data in relation to a water body to reach a finding of fact as to whether there is a degrading trend. And it may use the attribute bands in Appendix 2A to assist in coming to a view about that.
Are also the attributes in Appendix 2B of the NPS relevant when the Council considers whether, as a matter of fact, a water body is degraded or degrading?
Seem to find 2B in the
page 50 of the NPS.
Ah, thank you. Yes.
Answer yes, 2B and 2A are relevant.
Yes.
To a Regional Council when considering whether a water body is degraded or degrading. If, I think.
Clause 324 requires that certain provisions in relation to the loss of river extent and values be incorporated into regional plans. No time frame is given, but the obligation is as soon as reasonably practicable. Plainly, including those provisions in the operative plan and exercising them doesn't wait for the National Objectives Framework process. So really this is the essence of ORUG's case. It may seem ironic that farmers should be opposing PC7 on this basis, but the court needs to remember that farmers have devoted significant time, energy and investment over the last decade in preparing themselves for replacement permit applications. They have invested heavily in hydrological and ecological research to understand the nature and behaviour of the various catchments and put together integrated applications that are responsive to the values that have been identified. They hold the knowledge necessary for setting minimum and residual flows to protect habitat and freshwater ecosystems. Permit holders cannot and do not pretend to speak for Mana Whenua values, only they can do that for themselves. Tangata Whenua engagement obligations properly sit with the Regional Council representing the Crown as a treaty partner. That takes time. Time that threatened species may not have. Despite that, applications have sought to identify known values such as Meheka Kai and ensure that Meheka Kai species are provided for to the extent possible so that when wider issues such as fish passage through the Clutha main stem are resolved, there will be good habitat available for Meheka Kai species to enjoy. Farmers recognises that others may consider that different minimum and residual flows or allocation limits might be warranted compared to those which farmers might advance in their applications. The answer to that is twofold. Flow limit setting is a contestable process and each party and interest group must bring their values, research and evidence to the subject. Farmers recognise that they may not get what they want. And secondly, limit setting is an iterative process. No regional plan is set in stone, and reviews of plan limits are liable to occur at any time. Farmers know that Section 128(1)(b) of the Act enables regional councils to review conditions of permits and impose new limits. So what ORUG's saying to the court is that setting flow limits and levels through the resource consent process pursuant to the applications that have been prepared is not perfect. It is not a complete expression of Te Mana O Te Wai. But it is better than doing nothing. And the NOF process will take its course and may require new limits to be imposed in due course. And what ORUG says is that's a better expression of what the NPS anticipates than a period of hiatus in which no gain is made to the quality or quantity of any river in the meantime. I want to turn now to the Section 24A recommendation. The mandatory considerations for the court under Section 66 and 67 do not include a recommendation by the Minister. The fact that a recommendation is on foot does not change the obligations of the Otago Regional Council to test its response to the Minister's recommendation under Section 32 of the Act, or for the Environment Court to do so on this direct referral. It is admitted that this is both deliberate and necessary. The Minister is not constrained as to the scope of his recommendation powers, nor the matters that he has to consider in making a recommendation. Therefore, the role of the Council and the Environment Court in determining submissions on this plan change is an important quality control mechanism to ensure that the Minister's recommendation is not implemented without it having been carefully evaluated to ensure that it serves the purpose of the Act. This reveals something of a hole in the Regional Council's evidence. The Minister's recommendation to provide for an interim planning regime to effectively put the consents process on hold, although ironically requiring even more resource consent applications to be made, has not been critically evaluated by the Regional Council in its Section 32 report and supporting the notification of Plan Change 7. The Council's approach seems genuinely to be, well, if that is what the Minister recommends, then that is what we must do. There is a certain political expediency to that, but in my submission it is not what the law requires. The Minister, in referring Plan Change 7 to the Environment Court for decision, has set out his reasons for referral, which address why the plan change is a proposal of national significance as required by Section 142.3. The Court is obliged to have regard to the Minister's reasons. The Court is further required to step into the shoes of the local authority and the Regional Council. Section 66.1c of the Act requires the Regional Council to complete plan changes in accordance with ministerial directions under Section 25a, but not a recommendation under Section 24a. Paragraph 30 is a repetition, Mum. That can be struck out. Paragraph 31, the Regional Council's obligation in responding to the Minister's recommendation are also unchanged compared with any step it might take of its own initiative. Specifically, the Regional Council and now the Court must still satisfy itself as to the matters set out in Section 66, 67 and Section 32.1a. A recommendation offers no free pass around the Act's requirements. If the Court were to find that Plan Change 7 is consistent with the Minister's recommendation, but inconsistent with the requirements of the Act, then Plan Change 7 cannot be approved. Plan Change 7, as notified, and the evidence of both the ORC and the Ministry for the Environment proposes two levels of activity status under Plan Change 7, controlled activity and non-complying activity. Various planning witnesses suggest amendments to the policy and the rule framework, but the basic structure remains the same. In the Environment Court's decision in Cabra Rural Developments and Auckland Council, the Court at paragraph 50 set out the status of activities and by relation to the risk of adverse effects. It is submitted, and I wish those words to be added because that's a submission rather than a summary of the Court's finding. It is submitted that where the risk can be managed by standards in a plan on permitted activities, then the appropriate status is permitted and not controlled. The Council proposes to manage the risk of adverse effects, which it is currently unable to quantify, through the rules and the six-year permit term. The Council intends to incentivise short-term permits through the controlled activity status. However, the actual transaction costs perversely incentivise applications through the non-complying rule, which has the added attraction of at least the potential for a longer term. ORUG submits that the controlled activity status is not the most appropriate status for the easy route. The reason for this is not so much the certainty of outcome, but rather the question of where the costs of the consent process should properly lie.
Are you going to tease out that last sentence?
Yes. The Regional Council is entitled to and does charge for the processing of controlled activity resource consent applications. So there is a cost to an applicant, both in terms of obtaining expert advice and preparing the application, but also in the Council's cost in receiving it and processing it and issuing a new consent. And the counterfactual from ORUG submission is permitted activity status, in which deemed permit holders are enabled to continue to effectively exercise their permits under a permitted activity rule. So there is no transaction cost to permit holders under that regime.
Just let me read that with this paragraph with that in mind. What's the purpose of that last sentence? I understand what you're saying, and there is evidence on PC7 incentivising applications through the non-compliant route.
Yes.
So I understand that. Your submission, PC7... Oh, no, ORAG submits controlled activity status is not the most appropriate status for the easy route. So the most appropriate status for the easy route, are you saying that's permitted because then there would be no transaction costs, or in other words, costs associated with ORC processing and administering the resource consent? Is that your submission?
Yes, that's the submission.
Okay.
This is referable back to my cross-examination of Mr. De Peltzmaker on his paragraph 44, where he sets out the issues which have given rise to the need for Plan Change 7 in the Council's view. And what is apparent from his description of the issues is that they are all issues that pertain to the Regional Council's performance or the imposition of new national direction. They've got nothing to do with whether permit holders have caused a situation themselves which gives rise to the need to Plan Change 7. So bluntly, permit holders say, well, if this is your fault, ORC, why are we paying? And that's the reason for promoting a permitted activity rule. Now, that's ORUG's position. The court will have observed that Ms. Dicey has accepted that if there is to be a easy consenting pathway, then Mr. Ensor's version or some approximation of it is an acceptable route in her planning opinion. And Ms. Gilroy gave evidence about what she thought the likely processing cost of a 6-year controlled activity consent might be. Now, permit holders aren't going to die in the ditch over a few thousand dollars. But the cost to permit holders to date for consent hearings has been many tens of thousands of dollars and sometimes many hundreds of thousands of dollars, and that's what sticks in their craw.
Just to be clear, consent holders have been billed by the Regional Council for its costs in the vicinity of tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars, or consent holders have incurred tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars in relation to consents. Both questions pertain to obtaining consent under after PC7 was notified.
Both.
Okay, so the... Okay, both, all right. Made a note. Yep.
So if we effectively have, as Mr. Ensor suggests, a rubber stamp process where we get the controlled activity consent back again, then the argument about it becomes uneconomic. I'm spending more of my client's money standing here talking to you about it than it would cost them to go through that process. So on an economically rational basis, that's an acceptable outcome. But certainly as it was notified and even as it currently sits in Mr. De Peltzmaker's evidence, it's likely to be very expensive. And my clients say, well, that's not fair. It's not our fault. if we can exercise permitted activity status, then so much the better. Having said that, there is one upside from the controlled activity status, which is that you get to exercise a consent under Section 124 at the end of its term, whereas the permitted activity status doesn't have an equivalent. So there are some benefits.
For the record, is your client still seeking a permitted activity status under the water plan or not?
That relief is still alive, ma'am.
All right. So I need to make this really clear, and if I haven't done so already, forgive me. I need to know what is the relief your client is pursuing. I understood that your client was still pursuing a reject, and I do understand the reasons for that. I had thought your client had let go or was no longer pursuing relief under the water plan. That is the operative water plan. Now, plainly that is not correct if it is still seeking all resource consents for deemed permits and replacement permits are permitted. Now, you need to be clear where you're going with your case.
No. The relief in relation to the operative plan has been withdrawn.
Okay, so is it now... Okay, so what relief are you seeking? Because I haven't picked up, and obviously I haven't read it in enough detail if it's there, so Ms. Dicey will forgive me. I hadn't picked up that your client was also seeking a permitted activity rule under Plan Change 7.
Yeah, no. To be fair, Ms. Dicey's evidence is her response to what has been filed, particularly Mr. De Pelsmaker's supplementary evidence. And she presents what she says is an appropriate solution.
Which is a discretionary activity rule.
And it coupled with the controlled, yes.
Yeah.
Well, in fact, it's three. It's the controlled activity pathway akin to Mr. Rensselaer's version, a discretionary pathway for permits up to the year 2041, and non-complying beyond the year 2041.
Okay. Well, I can see that in her evidence.
Yeah.
In your submissions, written submissions now, as opposed to what you're telling the court, viva voce, are you saying that your client seeks a permitted activity rule under Plan Change 7?
My client's preference is for a permitted activity rule for the transaction costs reason, but the controlled activity rule proposed by Ms. Dicey is an acceptable solution.
For the purposes of a determination by this court, is it your expectation or requirement that the court determine whether or not there should be a permitted activity rule?
As matters currently stand, ma'am, the answer to that is yes.
Thank you. Now, is there any other matter that the court must determine in relation to relief being sought by your client, but which is not relief reflected in Ms. Dicey's evidence?
No.
All right. And is it your submission that the permitted activity rule is a rule that applies to deemed permits, the replacement of deemed permits, the replacement of any existing water permit? They're the first two categories.
Well, the permitted activity rule would apply to all of the permits that the controlled activity rule does. So the scope doesn't change, it's simply the status.
So whatever the scope of the controlled activity rule, I think in Mr. Enzel's evidence, possibly now in Ms. Dicey's evidence, whatever that scope of that rule, that is to those activities are to be permitted, is your submission. That's the relief sought by your client. And the reason for that is one pertaining to costs and the investment up to date made by applicants for resource consent and seeking replacement consents under both Plan Change 7 together with the water plan.
Yes.
And it makes it would make that submission seeking a permitted activity rule. I think you mentioned this, acknowledging that those persons who are permitted no longer have advantage of Section 124 of the Resource Management Act in terms of holding their priority relative to any other user which may come along seeking water permits.
It is acknowledged that Section 124 doesn't apply to permitted activities, yeah.
Is it also acknowledged that anybody who is seeking, anybody whose activities become permitted may lose? No, that's probably not right. Okay. So anyway, the primary relief for ORUG is that all water tanks are permitted in this region. All deemed permits and replacement permits are permitted in this region. That's its relief.
Yes, that is within the bounds of Plan Change 7 proceeding forward, that is the one bookend of the scope of relief for ORUG.
Right. Okay. It's not a negotiation. I just need to know what your relief is, that's all. All right, understood. That takes us to 11 o'clock, so... did you finish that paragraph, 38, or are you just about to start 38?
Well, I've just paraphrased 38 in my discussion with the court, so 39 is where we begin, I think.
We shall take the morning break. All rise.